Dance is only a game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Oh, rhythmically, the gymnasts have yet to dance for gold, and javelins will fly today. At least that's what I'm told. The water polo players must still sort the medals out. In taekwondo, the final still to come, without a doubt. Beyond those, much has been decided. Still, there's much to say, so time to call up Athens in the middle of the day. The Boston Globe's John Powers joins me now on the line. Hello, John.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. There are still medals to be distributed. What are the chief attractions in the final 2 days of the games?
The interesting story here is actually the performance of the U.S. track team, which had a black cloud over it because of the Balco-related steroid cases. They have already gotten more medals than they got in Sydney and have three relay shots tonight, which all could be gold.
There have been more instances internationally of doping at these games than perhaps ever before, or are people just more people getting caught?
More people appear to be getting caught. What's interesting is many of them are getting caught for stimulants, for steroids. What we haven't seen anything here is the human growth hormone EPO test, so which leads you to believe that maybe some of those tests may be coming down the road. I know that they have said that the test would be ready for Athens for human growth hormone, which is one of the most abused drugs. The question is whether it's really ready, and there's a possibility that they may be saving samples here and testing them later when the test is perfect.
The controversy regarding Paul Hamm's all-round gold medal is once again in the headlines because the Federation of International Gymnastics is pressuring Hamm to hand it back, give back his gold medal. Is this a reasonable request or just political gamesmanship?
It is an outrageous request. Actually, what is interesting, and this is almost an Alice in Wonderland scenario, the head of the International Gymnastics Federation has said repeatedly that it is impossible to change the result. The result will stand, but wouldn't it be nice if Paul Hamm, in the interest of fair play, gave the medal back? What has been most distressing about this, and we're now on day 17 of an eight-day meet, is that no one stood behind Paul Hamm who should have. USA Gymnastics did not. USOC finally yesterday did, but no one ever said it's over. This is just like, you know, any sporting event. When it's over and you've given the medals, here's how we knew it's over: when Paul Hamm appeared on David Letterman.
The Bush campaign refused to honor the USOC's request to pull ads featuring the Olympics. In the past, the International Olympic Committee has come down very hard on trademark infringements. Has the IOC finally met its match?
We believe so. I mean, one thing that we have found is that the U.S. does not seem to recognize the IOC's authority over the entire world. So I think that they have been distressed here. You know, mostly this first came from the Iraqi soccer team. They were very upset with the fact that George Bush was using them in his electoral campaign. But, you know, over here, it's just, you know, more hand-wringing about those crazy Americans. This time it just happens to be George Bush.
The U.S. women's softball team has already been dubbed the real U.S. Dream Team by Sports Illustrated, but the U.S. women's basketball team, which plays Australia for the gold in just a little while, certainly has a shot at similar booking, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the great untold stories of these games has been the U.S. women's basketball team, which certainly is every bit as dominant as the U.S. Dream Team was in 1992. All they do is just show up and win. And apparently that may not be good enough for some people.
Before Argentina plays mighty Italy for the gold medal in men's basketball, LeBron will try for the bronze. Will James and his U.S. teammates fall to Lithuania and go home without medal?
I think there's a very good chance of that. It's a very good Lithuanian team, and they are motivated. You know, beating the U.S., winning a bronze would be huge for them. I don't know if the Americans, who did not play well, certainly not in the second half against Argentina, are going to be interested in an afternoon match here for something that they did not come to get here. I mean, clearly, I think it's been a lost tournament for the U.S., and they really need to look hard as to how they want to do this next time.
John, most of the boxing news has been discouraging, at least for U.S. fans. Is boxing on the decline at the Olympic level, or were boxers from this country just poorly prepared this time around?
Well, I think what you've seen is a gradual descent in the quality of U.S. boxing anyway. I think they've got one medal at the last three games. They didn't qualify in two of the events here. Clearly, something is going on. It may be a federation problem. It may just be that you don't have enough people doing the sport. But clearly, it's off the radar screen as far as the major TV is going. But if you look back to the 1976 team with Leonard and all those guys, I mean, those are the glory days, and they don't appear to be coming back anytime soon.
Let's step beyond the narrow boundaries of nationalism, at least for a moment. What's the story that's most thoroughly captured the imagination of fans and writers there in Greece?
I think the most compelling story, certainly over the first week, has been the Iraqi men's soccer team, which is just delighted to be here and delighted to know that they would go home and not be tortured no matter how well they did here. So even winning one match was going to be massive for them. To be able to advance as far as they did has been one of the very nice stories of the games here. The other thing, too, is watching Greece celebrate its medals. Almost every day is a new heroine, a new hero, a new revelation, and that has been the real celebration for them, is to see the flag go up.
John, a curious question, at least I'm curious about it. Why is rhythmic gymnastics always at the end of the summer games?
That is a very good question, because normally by the end of the summer games, everything is out of rhythm here. Everyone is exhausted. What is interesting is it's all about ribbons and hoops and people going through hoops and waving ribbons, and I think it's a very fitting end of the games.
John, when it's all over, will IOC President Jacques Roga pronounce these games best or worst ever, or just, you know, pretty good?
He has seen what he likes not to do is to compare, because, of course, his predecessor, Juan Antonio Samaranch, always says, these were the best games.
Right.
But I think certainly these games have really exceeded expectations. First of all, the bar was set so low.
Right.
That almost anything. But I think these are games literally that people are going to hate to leave. There's been a wonderful organization here. If you had not told me that they weren't ready, 2-3 weeks ago, I would not have known that.
John Powers will cover the 2006 games in Turin. He has helped only a game unshroud Olympic mysteries for 7 Olympiads. He joined me on the line from Athens. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bill.
By one measure, the United States is a big winner at the Olympic Games. The U.S. leads all nations in total medals won. By a measure specific to the swimming competition, Speedo, one of the companies that claims to have developed the fastest swimsuit in the world for these Olympics, is triumphant. Swimmers from various nations wearing Speedo suits won 46 of the 96 medals awarded, and 17 of those medals were gold. Maybe that's why Steve Furness, the founder and executive vice president of TEER, manufacturer of another alleged world's fastest suit, is suspicious about the validity of directly comparing the two manufacturers in terms of medals won.
I'm an old school guy. I haven't been a former swimmer in a couple Olympics. And when I was doing it, less suit was better. But the reality is, suits don't make swimmers. You know, we could put a burlap sack on Thorpe or Phelps, and they're still going to swim awful fast.
Ian Thorpe, the winner of 4 medals, and Michael Phelps, the winner of 8, are both under contract to Speedo. Paul Bemis, the vice president of a company called Fluent Technology that tests the suits made by Speedo, agrees with Speedo's competition about the difference the particular athletes make.
I have to tell you, the human is the biggest component of winning or losing. Michael Phelps swims 365 days a year. Even Christmas Day, he swims. So I don't think there's any substitute for the athlete. To be quite honest, I don't think the swimmers are thinking about the suits. They're thinking about getting through the water as quick as they can.
At least some of the swimmers at the current games thought they could get through the water more quickly if they traded the suits they were supposed to wear for something else. The members of South Africa's gold medal-winning 4x100 relay team slipped out of the Speedo suits their National Swimming Association had told them to wear and raced in power skin suits made by Arena, apparently believing that company's claim that its suits were the fastest. According to TEER founder Steve Furness, Speedo, like the South African Swimming Association, had reason to be dismayed.
This is a marketing game as much as it is a performance game, and the best technology doesn't always win. It's the people with the biggest checkbooks to buy the fastest athletes. So our challenge is, as a smaller company, if we could buy more athletes, I can guarantee you that we would generate more medals.
Swimmers wearing TEER suits collected 5 gold, 4 silver, and 2 bronze medals, an encouraging statistic for Steve Furness because it represents a considerable improvement over his company's performance in Sydney. Professor Mark Glickman, an expert in statistics at Boston University, would question anyone who suggests that Speedo's 17 gold medals mean that company's suit is faster.
I don't think so. I don't think you can draw that conclusion just from that information. If it turns out that the number of non-winners that were wearing Speedo was, say, 1,000, and the number of non-winners wearing TEER was something like 1, then all of a sudden tier starts looking pretty good because in proportion they actually won a lot more gold medals.
The claims of the particular swimsuit manufacturers aside, there's no denying that the look of the sport has changed. Now there are suits with legs, suits with sleeves, suits that reduce drag, and suits including ridges that channel the water through which the racers race. Anything to cut the hundredths of a second that might make all the difference. I asked Paul Bemis, the tester of Speedo swimsuits, whether the suits were in danger of entering the realm of flubber, that magical compound for sneaker bottoms that helped basketball players jump over the rim in the movies.
As long as the playing field is even and everybody has the same flubber, so to speak, then it's just a relative comparison. You notice they're all wearing suits of different shape and size and manufacturer, and it just becomes a relative comparison, not a one advantage versus another.
Whether because of the suits, or the athletes, or what the athletes thought about the suits, or all of the above, the swimmers at the 2004 Games set 16 Olympic records and 8 world records. It's 18 minutes past the hour. For fans planning to visit the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing, the organizing committee there has already prepared a helpful phrasebook. The colorful text includes pictures. The first lesson equips tourists to say,
Ni hao,
which means hello. In a later chapter, visitors learn to say, the sports facilities are very good, everything is exceptionally well organized, and the service is great. In chapter 20, one finds oneself remarking, the sky is bluer, the water is clearer, and Beijing is becoming more and more beautiful. It certainly sounds as if the organizing committee in Beijing is planning on putting on the best games ever.
Shalom!
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the return of the marathon to the course where it began, sort of. But first, as far as publicity is concerned, for Greece the games have been a mixed blessing at best. Hometown fans have not been without champions to cheer, but disappointment and embarrassment have perhaps outweighed the celebration. Joining me now to discuss these circumstances is Olympics historian David Walachinsky, author of several editions of the complete book of the Olympics. David, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you so much.
Historically, the athletes of the host country have done very well at the Games, much better than they've done at somebody else's Games. But that can't be said of the Greek athletes, can it?
Well, normally that's the case. In 1976, the Canadians did not win a gold medal at their own Games. But historically, yes, a host country will usually do well at their own Games. The Greeks are winning their gold medals and winning other medals. I noticed that the Greek judo champion couldn't speak Greek, but at least he was competing for Greece.
Well, among the Greek athletes, two baseball players who may or may not have been able to speak Greek failed drug tests. Two sprinters missed a test, claimed they'd been in a motorcycle accident, and subsequently withdrew from the games. A weightlifter was stripped of his bronze medal for failing a drug test after the competition. No previous host country has had problems like this.
No, but there are no host country has also had to deal with such severe drug testing. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where we're suspicious of Greek runners. We had a gold medal winner, Fani Halkia, win the 400-meter hurdles for women. And I have to say I was a little taken aback. This was not a major runner. She had improved her best time by almost 3.5 seconds in 1 year, and given the case of the Greek sprinters who refused to take drug tests, I'll be waiting to see if she retires next week or if we have another story coming a year or so from now.
Well, now, it's interesting that you bring her up because we've been talking about her performance. She just doesn't look as if she's taking steroids.
Well, that's certainly the hope. But, you know, you don't have to be taking steroids. You can be taking other drugs. You can be taking EPO, human growth hormone, and other drugs that might improve your performance. Mind you, you know, back in the days before people had heard of drugs, you know, in the 20s and 30s, there are instances of people having dramatic improvements in an Olympic year. It's not like it's not possible without drugs.
Though the games have run smoothly, credit to the organizers, certainly, fans of a Greek boxer, Elias Pavlidis, bombarded the ring with water bottles, some of them half full, when his fight was stopped by the referee and his opponent had to flee the ring, fearing for his safety. Is it fair to say Greek fans are responsible for the worst sportsmanship at the games?
Oh, not even close. First of all, when we're talking about sportsmanship and problems at the Olympics, you have to take boxing and put it in a different category. You can go back as far as the 1920s when throwing bottles, that's nothing. You know, I mean, how about, you know, jumping into the ring, attacking the referee, as happened in 1988, charging the judge's bench. I myself was at a fight in Los Angeles in 1984 where this young unknown boxer, somebody named Evander Holyfield, was disqualified, and the judges had to be escorted out of the arena by policemen. So, you know, you have to take boxing and say, well, this is just another story.
Some of the recent games have been remarkable for the fact that they haven't lost money. I gather that the best estimate now is that the final price tag for the games in Athens may be $12.5 billion, and the Greek population will be paying that debt down for at least a decade, people say. So this has to be among the most hapless and hideous financial fiascos among Olympics.
I think this might very well be the case. You know, Montreal lost a lot of money in 1976, and I think we could see this again. It amuses me. I watch with a smirk as everybody hails the Athens Organizing Committee and what a wonderful job they did. And I want to see how they, the Greek public feels about this a couple months from now, a year from now, when they realize how their taxes are going to be raised or how much money they're going to be paying for the next three generations.
Some of the organizers in Athens are claiming that although tourism has fallen off this summer, Athens will get a rush of visitors after the games. Does it usually work that way in the wake of the Olympics?
It can work. Actually, can work either way. What this is good for Athens is it does show off Athens to the world, all over the world, not just in the United States, but all over. People are seeing images of how beautiful Greece is, and it really is beautiful. And not only that, I don't know how it's being covered in the United States because I'm in Athens, but boy, the Greek people sure are nice. If that spreads around the world, then yeah, you are going to get increased tourism in Greece. It may not happen next month, but it is going to happen over the next couple years.
Do you suppose that the games in Athens will encourage or discourage other cities from seeking to host the Olympics?
What has happened in Athens will have no effect on other cities bidding for the Olympics, because once the Olympics were proved to be potentially profitable, which was in 1984, then all over the world, you saw businessmen and entrepreneurs with you know, dreams of euros clicking in their head or dollars, depending on where they're from, or rubles. and so you're just having no shortage of cities bidding for the Olympics. And, you know, now they see increased security is a big problem in terms of financing. But also, as we've seen here in Athens, the world is ready to help a host city in terms of security.
All right, David, you have convinced me that the Greek athletes have performed more successfully than I had thought. So Greece perhaps isn't the least successful home team as far as the Olympics is concerned. Montreal holds that distinction, I gather, but who else is close?
Well, I mean, if you go to the Winter Olympics in Sarajevo, Yugoslavia, it was considered a national celebration when one of the ski jumpers won a medal. But that was because, you know, Yugoslavia had no record of ever winning anything in the Winter Olympics, but they were willing to host it anyway. So expectations were low, but that is the record.
David Walachinsky is the author of The Complete Book of the Summer Olympics and The Complete Book of the Winter Olympics as well, both published by Sport Classic Books. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
In the true spirit of the Games, so goes the official slogan of Athens 2004. It's a good one because although history has come full circle with the return of the Olympics to Athens, there are questions regarding the authenticity, if not the spirit, of one of this Olympiad's premier competitive events. From Athens, Joanna Kakissis reports.
From the giant television screen in Panathinaiko Stadium, the beginning of the women's marathon looked like the perfect Olympic moment. The world's best long-distance runners took off on Sunday from the historic town of Marathon, just northeast of Athens, to run the 26.2 miles, which, according to ancient lore, killed a Greek messenger more than 2,500 years ago. The gold medal favorite was Great Britain's Paula Radcliffe, the women's world record holder. She raced to an early lead as her fans cheered and waved "We Love Paula" signs. Gloria Wilkie had come from southern England to see Radcliffe make Olympic history.
I feel like the marathon was one of the original sporting events for the whole of the Olympics, and I think it symbolises what the Olympics is about. The endurance of it is very special, and because we have Paula Radcliffe, who's absolutely fantastic, so that was a must come and see, really.
The marathon has become the symbolic centrepiece of the 2004 Games. Greece spent millions of euros widening the narrow roadway between Marathon and Athens to give runners more room and television networks better camera angles. The revamped route, like many Athens venues, was completed just before the Games began. But is the 2004 Marathon route historically accurate? Probably not, says Alexander Kitrev, a history professor at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. He is the author of the book Wrestling with the Ancients, Modern Greek Identity and the Olympics.
The Battle of Marathon is historically accurate, and we know that the warriors at Marathon sent someone to alert the Athenians that they had won the battle. But we are not sure that there was a runner who ran back to Athens and collapsed in the main agora, the main square, saying, "Neni kikamen, we won." Many ancient historians believe that the run has to do more with legend than fact.
In fact, historians believe the marathon is a modern invention inspired by two conflicting stories about the Persian Wars in 490 BC. According to the first story, the messenger Pheidippides ran 153 miles in 36 hours, that's a distance from Athens to Sparta, to get help to fight the Persians who had just landed in Marathon. In the second, more widely repeated version, he ran the 26 miles from Marathon to Athens to tell city magistrates that Athenians had triumphed against the Persians. After he reached Athens, he collapsed from exhaustion and died.
It doesn't matter at all whether it's legend or fact. The modern marathon was born with the modern Olympics. It was an associate of the founder of the modern Olympics, Baron de Coubertin. A friend of his had the idea that the first modern Olympics in Athens ought to include a race which began at Marathon and ended at Athens. This was the first Olympic marathon, and since then, the marathon has been included in the Olympics, and it's grown to become one of the signature events of the Olympic Games.
The 1896 marathon route was mapped along the coastal countryside between Athens and the site of the ancient Battle of Marathon. A Greek shepherd named Spiridon Lewis won the race. It is the same course run by this year's Olympians, who run past the fast food joints and car dealerships of modern Greece. Kostas Kordilas, a modern Greek historian at King's College in London, says the myth of the marathon has now become an historical reality.
I think most modern Greeks live more with myths than actual reality as far as the ancient past is concerned. Classical Greece has been elevated to a sort of sacred status. It doesn't really matter if it existed, as long as we believe in it.
Thank you for being with us. In the Athens suburb of Neopsychico, a 29-year-old French teacher named Elisa Galani watched as Paula Radcliffe dropped out of Sunday's marathon in tears, exhausted and spent in the 90-degree heat. Galani was annoyed when the camera crews crowded around the fallen Radcliffe. But as the rest of the runners disappeared toward the finish line, she felt like she was watching history. The marathon, she said, had become its own reality.
The magic of the marathon is that the Olympics have come home. This year, the news has been all about doping, especially if it involves our athletes, the Greek athletes. Times are not as pure as they used to be, I know, but the magic is still here.
On Sunday, an Olympic marathoner entered Panathinaiko Stadium for the first time in 108 years. 88-pound Mizuki Noguchi from Japan won the race in 2 hours and 26 minutes. The men's marathon, the last competitive event of the Athens Games, will take place on the mythical route tomorrow. For Only a Game, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
Share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Listening to Only a Game. The hundreds of hours of television generated by the 2004 Olympics have left viewers with lots of images by which to remember the games. The triumph of Fanny Halkia as she circled the track wrapped in the Greek flag after winning the 400-meter hurdles on Wednesday. The presentation of Michael Phelps as happy, selfless American flag-waving spectator as his teammates set a record in the 4x100 medley relay, securing Phelps his 8th medal in the process. Larry Brown and Spanish coach Mario Pescara barking at each other after the U.S. men's basketball team upset Spain in the quarterfinals. And who ever thought anybody would be using upset in that context at the Olympics? The Olympics also leaves me with other questions. For example, what odds could I have gotten if I'd had the foresight to bet that the first Israeli to win an Olympic gold medal would be a windsurfer? What was going through the alleged mind of the U.S. boxer who explained his lackluster performance by saying that he figured he was going to lose anyway, so why should he risk getting hit in the head while losing? I mean, I can see the logic in his thinking. It's part of the reason why I've never boxed. But he and I are in different circumstances, aren't we? He went to the Olympics as a boxer. Then there's the matter of whether any event could ever do as much for globalization as these Olympics have done. Consider 6-time Olympian Jamaican sprinter Merline Oddi running for Slovenia this time around. And what about Irina Lashko of the formerly Soviet Union Lashkos diving for Australia, or former Kenyan Wilson Kipketer's bid to become the most celebrated Dane since Hamlet? Apparently, partying has been especially hardy at these games. How else to explain how Dutch rower Diederik Simon left his silver medal in a taxi that was taking him back to the Olympic Village after a night on the town? And how to explain the state of mind that led Nicolas Massu, the Chilean tennis player who won gold medals in both the singles and the doubles competition, to leave both medals in his bedroom at the Village when he returned to Chile? Were they a tip for the chambermaid? I'm curious, too, about how long it took for the photo of Misty May and Kerry Walsh celebrating after winning gold in beach volleyball to become the most often downloaded picture from Athens. And finally, there are the names. Think on Stubby Clapp. He played second base for Canada. If anybody can think of a better name for a baseball player than Stubby Clapp, please let me know. And he still came in only second in the 2004 Olympics name derby. That's because of the presence of an Australian bronze medal-winning diver named Ludi Turkey. Ludi Turkey, Ludi Turkey, Ludi Turkey. You try saying that name three times fast without smiling. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, rolling along with the Crimson Tide. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Da, 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 da. Hi, Bill.
Was that the closing anthem or the opening
anthem?
No,
I don't know. The Olympics will go on forever.
That's probably true. Last week, you said that you would wait for track and field to pick your favorite Olympic moment. So what have you got for us?
Well, actually, I was good to do that. The 1,500 meters, Mr. Al-Gharouj from Morocco, hanging on, struggling, gasping, finally winning his gold medal was my favorite moment.
All right. That takes care of the gold. Have you a candidate for the bronze?
Actually, I do. I want to compliment the organizing committee in Greece for finding the most beautiful recorded version of the Star Spangled Banner I've ever heard. It's got a string section in the middle that makes the national anthem sound like a Christmas carol. It's wonderful.
Moments after Fani Halkia delighted the home country fans by winning the 400-meter hurdles, speculation about whether she had indulged in performance-enhancing substances began. I guess it's automatic in track and field these days, but it was kind of too bad.
Well, when you reduce your previous time by 4 seconds on the biggest stage of all, and given the cloud that's over track and field in general now, yeah, it is probably the most natural thing in the world.
On Thursday, the U.S. women defeated the Brazilian soccer team 2-1 for gold. I trust you regard this Olympic championship as the appropriate punctuation for the careers of Mia Hamm, Julie Foudy, and the other retiring veterans of that team.
I have absolutely no comment on that.
That's all right. I'll talk about it some more if you like.
No, I think, and can I please, you did it too. You are Mr. Women's Soccer and you did it too. Can we please say the name Brianna Scurry, which never gets mentioned when these women get lined up? She had another great game on a big stage.
She did indeed. She's had several great games. And I also want to say the name of Mr. Wright Post, who saved the U.S. soccer team from certain defeat.
That's right. He was a gentleman in a blazer and a sailor cap from North Carolina, right?
Charlie, for some reason, LeBron James decided early in the week to issue a challenge to U.S. softball team pitcher Jenny Finch. He said, "She couldn't strike me out." I wonder if he knows what happened when Ted Williams tried to hit against Ray Bestus Brakett's ace Joan Joyce in 1961.
Well, the great thing about this, and I certainly hope it happens, I mean, this would be a great event, is Finch went right back at him saying, "All I need is three pitches. I'd even throw a changeup on the first one."
The organizers in Athens claimed that during week two of the games, venues were about 92% full. I just have to wonder how all the people in those seats managed to climb under them each time the TV cameras panned around to their sections.
Well, I mean, you did have in the second week, you did have track and field, and the stadium was pretty full with, admittedly, obstreperous local fans.
Some of them.
I have no doubt that sales picked up. I have no doubt that if you get an honest count at the end of the Olympic, the sales figures will be disappointing.
Back on the domestic scene, ABC is apparently trying to figure out whether to continue broadcasting Monday Night Football. The network has been losing about $150 million a year on this program. How can Monday Night Football be a loser? That's un-American.
Let's assume for a moment that the ABC figures are a lie, this being television and all. If ABC does sack Monday Night Football, it's important to remember that ABC is all, and ESPN are also owned by the same company. There will be Monday Night Football. It may not be on ABC, but that will be the end of a revolutionary moment in sports television.
In the waning days of August, if you flew American Airlines, you learned via their in-flight entertainment video that Quincy Carter was one of the keys to the Dallas Cowboys season. This, no doubt, will surprise Mr. Carter and Coach Bill Parcells, because Carter was cut by the Cowboys almost a month ago. How come nobody told American Airlines?
No, but does anybody watch that stuff? I mean, every time I look up, Frazier's on. No one's going to notice Quincy Carter.
Oh, that's a good point. There has been no progress, Charlie, in the talks between the National Hockey League and its players this week. The sides will meet again next week. Where have I heard that before? Has everyone been so involved with Olympic field hockey they haven't paid any attention to this or haven't gotten anything done?
Well, it's not precisely true that no progress has been made. The rhetoric has gotten more intense and more irreconcilable. The union is now saying that this is Gary Bettman attempting to lock his legacy into place by getting a salary cap for the owners. This is probably true, but, you know, again, this is a sport that's going to lock out its players and nobody's going to notice.
It promises to be an action-packed inaugural weekend for college football, Charlie.
Certainly at your house.
Without any doubt. But you got some picks for us on this first weekend?
I think North Dakota State's going to open at home against Valparaiso with a big win on Saturday night.
The PA announcer for the minor league Atlantic City Surf was canned for dedicating the anthem YMCA to the governor of New Jersey. Then, in part at Governor McGreevy's request, the announcer was rehired. The team owner said he's a great believer in second chances. Apparently, those in New Jersey who called for Governor McGreevy's resignation are not great believers in second chances.
Well, this is one of these kind of things. The way that we have public dialogue now is you say something completely uncivil and do something completely indecent, and then you say you're sorry, and everybody calls you brave and gives you a second chance.
This week's candidate for most unlikely pairing of a sport with a country is surfing with Switzerland. How do you like the idea of catching a wave in Zurich?
Those of us who go to Tahiti for alpine skiing every year are not surprised by this at all.
And finally, Charlie, members of Britain's Royal Pigeon Racing Association have come up with an idea for protecting their birds from the predators that have been snacking on them, though I gather the plan is not without some distasteful drawbacks.
Yeah, they're going to spray the pigeons with chemicals that taste bad or feed them a special diet that'll make them unpleasant to eat. My question is, pigeons don't already taste bad?
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park.
Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me
as we poison the pigeons in the park.
When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide.
But they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide.
The sun shining bright.
Everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Poison the pigeons in the park. And maybe we'll do in a squirrel or two while we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We'll murder them all amid laughter and merriment. Except for the few we take home for experiment. My pulse will be quickening with each drop of strychnine we feed to a pigeon. It just takes a smidgen to poison a pigeon in the park.
La 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 la.
There are those who think there is no better way to spend a Saturday afternoon or evening in the fall than to attend a big-time college football game. And then there are those who think there is no better way to spend a couple of days before the game than to hunker down in the parking lot waiting. In order to write Rammer Jammer Yellowhammer, Warren St. John spent the 2000 season with the rolling community of Alabama football fans who attend games in campers and recreational vehicles. Warren St. John joins me now from NPR's New York studios. Warren, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you happen to decide that the best route into Alabama football was to join the weekly caravan of RVs occupied by Alabama's fans?
Well, as a kid, I grew up in Birmingham, and I always wandered through this vast maze of RVs outside the stadium. And it just, growing up there, it's something that you see so often, you fail to note how unusual it is. And I've lived in New York now for a number of years, and I would go back for games. And every time I saw it, and of course it's grown over the years, I was more and more taken by what an incredible phenomenon this was. And I felt that I needed to dive in myself and try to understand what was going on and why people would drive their, essentially drive their homes to a football stadium.
You write of the joy that fans feel when Alabama wins, quote, "The glee is pure and uncomplicated, the crystalline contentment of childhood accessed miraculously years into adulthood." But, of course, the flip side of that glee is despair at an Alabama loss, and certainly you witnessed and felt despair as well.
Well, this season sort of unfurled perfectly for my purposes with a terrible loss at home. And then 3 weeks later, Alabama beat Florida in the swamp, where Florida had not lost in 5 years. It allowed me to see the full range and to experience the full range of emotion, and I tried to capture that as best as I could.
Alcohol plays a major part in the activities of the community that you came to know. That may be the understatement of the day with regard to this book, but to what extent are these folks just frat guys who never grew up?
There's certainly a wide range. I mean, there are a lot of families who go to these games, but it's definitely an indulgent atmosphere. And simply owning a $300,000 or $600,000 RV, one could argue, is an act of indulgence. These things get 4 or 5 miles per gallon. One thing I found about these hardcore fans is that they did pretty much everything in extremis. There was no moderation. This is not a group searching for the golden mean. These are people embracing embracing their urges.
You write that at a typical Alabama game, between 250 and 800 motorhomes will show up. Of one of the more spectacular vehicles, you've written, quote, "Taken as a whole, the interior looks like Graceland jammed into a closet." Tell me a little more about that particular mobile home.
Well, that was a $1.3 million RV, and the owner of it was a man who'd made his fortune building chicken houses in Alabama, and he'd done quite well for himself and was actually diagnosed with cancer. And as a sort of final act of indulgence on earth, he sold his business and bought this incredible contraption that had fax machines and washers and dryers and every conceivable type of mood lighting you could think of. And and the irony was that he got better, and he was stuck with this $1.3 million RV. But people, of course, were always intrigued to see it, so he spent his Saturdays giving tours to the tens of thousands of people who would show up for Alabama football games.
All right. What made you decide that you had to have some sort of mobile home of your own?
The invitations to join other fans dried up after the second week. I managed to find a South Carolina couple who invited me along for the first weekend, and then a show chicken breeder from North Alabama who invited me along for the second. But after that, I was on my own, and so I quickly went through the classifieds of the Birmingham News and found a 1978 motorhome, a $5,500 RV, which you can imagine next to a $1.3 million RV, what $5,500 gets you. It more or less worked. It got me most of the time where I was going, if not always on time. And it actually helped to build my cred with this community, because they saw me on my back underneath my RV fixing things just as they were. So over time, I think it helped, and it certainly allowed me to really go deep in this culture.
Among your adventures when you were looking for a mobile home was an encounter with a gentleman who was very grumpy, and you didn't find out until later why that was.
Sure, that was when I was shopping for RVs, and this was a rather sullen individual, and we had a test drive together, and I was a little uncertain about why he was in such a foul mood, and he sort of later acknowledged that it was because his wife had mandated the sale of his RV. And he was so reluctantly put it in the paper. And I asked him if the generator worked. And of course, the generators on these things power the air conditioner and the refrigerators and everything else. So they're pretty vital, especially in the hot late summer and early fall of football season in the South. And it didn't work. And he was very frustrated by this, started rummaging around in the generator compartment with a giant screwdriver. And I heard a tremendous snap and a blue flash of light. And I saw him flying backwards as he got a jolt from the car battery that ran this thing. He quickly got up and dusted himself off and said, "Don't worry, I work for the power company," as if somehow this explained his ability to recover from a sudden jolt of electricity.
You write of the fans who inhabit parking lots together throughout the fall that their connections, the connections between them are, quote, as fleeting as they are intense. These folks don't have all that much to do with each other beyond the parking lots, I gather.
That's right. Many of them don't know each other's last names, actually. And there's this community that forms instantly at the beginning of football season. It's incredibly tight and intimate, especially when you're at an away stadium and you really feel like the world outside is hostile and people sort of bond together. But on Sunday morning, after the last game, people get in their RVs and then take off to their lives outside of football. And without this glue of fandom to hold them together, they quickly sort of blend back into the fabric of American culture, only to reconvene next season.
Warren, late in the book, you write, quote, I've spent a month in Tuscaloosa. When I arrived, I didn't especially want to be there. Now I don't especially want to leave. Were you worried when you realized that you felt that way?
Well, part of the story of the book is about my getting drawn in. And I embarked on this with a sense of objectivity. I'm a reporter for The New York Times, and I dove into this world just the way any reporter would. But because I was a fan, I quickly found that it was impossible to be objective. And I tried to exploit that tension that I felt. And by the end of the season, of course, I'd gotten to know all the players. I knew all of their stories. I was totally immersed and therefore totally hooked. And what I found was that the more you know about the team, the more you can identify with the players, the harder it is to step back and not get completely drawn in.
Does the experience of spending so much time and such intense time around the team and its fans, has it changed the way that you're going to relate to Alabama football this season? Are you going to travel to watch the team? Are you going to be in Tuscaloosa? What's your plan?
I'm going to go to several games this season, but I think the process of the book and the goal of the book ultimately was try to find a way to be an enlightened fan, to see if there was some way to enjoy the process of totally giving yourself over to the fan experience without totally abandoning rationality. And so it's the process of reporting it and writing the book has definitely changed the way I feel about sports. And it's made me more aware of what's happening emotionally to me as a game goes on. But it hasn't made me any less depressed over a loss or any less happy after a win. And therefore, I plan to be there in person as much as possible.
Warren St. John is the author of Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, published by Crown. He joined me from NPR's New York studios. Warren, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been fun.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Special thanks to Steph Katsonis, Kathleen McKenna, and Howard Berkus. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out Only a Game's own swimsuit issue. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Tier CEO Steve Furness.
To be honest with you, I don't think we need to get the toddlers into these suits until they get a little older. So I think a standard suit will suit them fine.
Well, sure, but I hear Speedo's already designed a toddler bathing suit for the future offspring of Michael Phelps. They're calling it Future Gold 2024. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.